Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. Later in the program, David Katie Johnston will join us to talk about the Trump administration's unprecedented efforts to limit press freedom, plus the just-passed House budget resolution that could cut $880 billion from Medicaid over the next decade. But first, we're going to discuss Battle for Tibet, a new frontline documentary that examines how the Chinese government is controlling Tibet, drawing on undercover footage, interviews with Tibet and China experts, Chinese government statements, and accounts from Tibetans now living in exile. Battle for Tibet examines the Chinese government's tight control over the territory, including its system of boarding schools and a vast network of surveillance inside places like Buddhist monasteries. To discuss the documentary, we're so pleased to be joined by Geshbin Mohammed, a BAFTA and Emmy-winning journalist and documentary filmmaker, as well as the director of Battle for Tibet. Welcome to the program, Geshbin.
Thank you so much for having us, Ethan.
And I just want to let listeners know you can stream Battle for Tibet on Frontline's website, Frontline's YouTube channel, or the PBS app. Now, first of all, Geshbin, thank you so much for this documentary. It's really an excellent, riveting film. And I know you have covered China extensively. You have Peabody Award-winning China Undercover, which detailed extensive digital surveillance of the Uyghur Muslim population living in Xinjiang province. You also cover the protest movement in Hong Kong. Why did you decide to focus on Tibet for your latest documentary, and why now?
Well, one of the reasons, I suppose, is Tibet is obviously one of the world's most tightly guarded regions. And last year, Freedom House gave Tibet a global freedom score of 0, attributing it to China's policies in Tibet. And having investigated China's policies in other ethnic minority areas, this felt like a sort of natural sort of sequel to those investigations. And obviously, the Chinese government has been saying that human rights are protected, but those that have escaped Tibet or left Tibet and are now living in exile have been, for years saying that they feel that their religion and their culture is being controlled. So we wanted to look at, the allegations and what the Chinese government is saying.
And Tibet seemed like it was in the news a lot, perhaps in the 80s and 90s, when there was a lot of issues happening there that you do go into some extent in the documentary, particularly around succession plans for the Dalai Lama. But is there something interesting happening now? I'm wondering what you feel like is sort of the latest update, the hook that should make people really pay attention to what's happening to Tibet at this moment.
Obviously, as it's been 75 years since China invaded Tibet, and this is a particularly critical point with the Dalai Lama approaching 90 this year. So there has been questions obviously raised about what's next for Tibet when the Dalai Lama eventually passes away. And that was, we tried to look at it through that frame. And this is, this film is part of a wider conversation and other reporting that's happening. But essentially, this is a pivotal point for Tibet in terms of what's next for Tibet. And obviously, we're looking at what's happening now. And there are obviously critical things that are happening in Tibet right now, such as the new education policies and children being placed into kindergarten schools where they are being taught in Mandarin. And one of our sources, an academic and sociologist, Gyal Lo, has been examining this at great length. And he went around schools across Tibetan areas, and he found that the schools are also teaching children communist ideology. And he feels that that's a real threat to Tibetan culture and language in the future.
And as mentioned in the documentary, China heavily restricts international media access to the region, but you were able to send an investigative journalist into Tibet, some pretty striking undercover type footage. How difficult and challenging was it to make this film, just given the censorship and the repressive surveillance of the population within Tibet?
It was very difficult, Ethan. We worked with a journalist who agreed to go undercover to Tibet. And obviously for his safety, there's, not much that I can say, but it was we had to take into account his safety as well as those that he, secretly filmed, essentially. So Tibetans and Han Chinese living in Tibetan areas in China. And he went around and tried to strike up conversation, with people, taxi drivers, people in cafes, and because of the surveillance, this was, you know, one of the most sort of difficult investigations I've ever done.
And it occurred to me in watching the footage that just given the power of the surveillance state, AI, facial recognition technology, is there a chance that China might be able to go back and piece together the footage that your undercover investigative journalist was able to take with the scene and perhaps uncover that journalist's identity? Is there that risk going forward for the person who helped you put the film footage together?
That's always certainly a concern in these types of investigations. And we have very sort of very thorough risk assessments and protocols that we follow to try and mitigate those risks. That's very much a concern that keeps me awake at night. And certainly in Tibet, what stood out to the reporter and in the footage, obviously when I was watching it back, was the level of surveillance in Tibet and the impact that's having on Tibetans. One of the people that our reporter speaks to, you know, talks about how in the past they used to go to monasteries, but now obviously government employees, he says, can't go anymore to monasteries, and if you're caught by camera, you'd be expelled. And so there, the surveillance is obviously preventing people from expressing themselves.
Well, you document that quite well, and certainly with the footage you have, it's just about how pervasive the footage is, the police control there. You know, it occurs to me that a number of listeners listening to this program today may not have that much familiarity with Tibet and the sort of brief recent history of Tibet and China's occupation of Tibet. Can you maybe just for those listeners, just describe in a nutshell, you know, which I know is hard to do, the history of Tibet and its relationship with China and what's been happening in recent decades?
Yes. I mean, I guess, you know, this conflict really is, if you really crystallize what this conflict is really about, it's about, you know, whether Tibet is separate or a part of China and whether it's always been part of China. Obviously, almost 75 years ago, China invaded Tibet. And China would say Tibet has always been part of China since ancient times and that will always be part of China. But I suppose Tibetans, Tibetans feel that they are different, that they have their own culture, their own religion, their own language. And so there's this sort of conflict and inherent tension about whether China is the legitimate ruler of Tibet. And at the center of this battle is really the Dalai Lama, who's obviously the living symbol of Tibetan resistance.
Yes. Are you still able to hear me?
Yeah. Oh, no, I didn't hear anything for a bit there.
Okay, sorry, just wasn't sure if you were going to finish that. That's great. I really appreciate the summary there of Tibetan history. I know it's not the easiest thing to summarize. I want to let listeners know we're speaking with Geshbin Mohammed, Emmy-winning journalist and documentary filmmaker and director of the PBS Frontline documentary Battle for Tibet, available on Frontline's website, Frontline's YouTube channel, or the PBS app. I also want to open up the phone lines and invite listeners to join the conversation. Have you been to Tibet? Have you seen some of this surveillance state? Do you have relatives or friends from Tibet? Or do you have thoughts about the documentary, having watched Battle for Tibet? You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Well, Geshbin, I also wanted to talk to you about the people, the several Tibetans who are in diaspora that you talked to. They fled the country after being imprisoned or after having been in fear that they would be imprisoned by the Chinese government. Given the Chinese control over the region, how difficult is it for Tibetans to leave Tibet at this point?
Well, it's very difficult, and historically, many more have been able to leave the borders of China. But today, there aren't that many that are able to leave, largely due to border restrictions. And we talked to a young woman whose name is Namchi, whose story and experience is an example of the struggle that has raged between Tibet and China. And at the age of 15, she protested, calling for the Dalai Lama's return, but was sentenced to 3 years imprisonment for separatist acts against the nation. And she really left. She left her hometown and is now living in India because she feels that she wants to tell her own true story. And she feels that within the borders of China, she's not able to do that.
And of course, China considers Tibet part of China, as we see in the documentary. Now, why is Tibet important for China? And particularly when we think about the Dalai Lama repeatedly saying that he only wants autonomy for Tibet, not full independence. So what is China's view towards Tibet? Why is China against allowing the Dalai Lama to return?
Well, yes. The film essentially examines China's branding of the Dalai Lama as what the Chinese would call, they call the Dalai Lama an anti-China separatist, despite his repeated statements that he's no longer seeking Tibetan independence and would accept self-rule within China. This is something that goes back to into history. And we spoke to an academic, Robert Barnett, who's renowned sort of in Tibetan academia, and he essentially, you know, he got these internal Chinese documents from the 1990s, where effectively the Chinese government started this sort of policy to demonize the Dalai Lama. And as Barnett says in the documentary, all Chinese policy since then has been based on that decision essentially, and that really sheds light on that relationship between the Dalai Lama and China, that even though the Dalai Lama is no longer calling for independence, that he is still demonized. And as we know, there are back channel negotiations about his return. We don't have any sort of additional insight into that. But there are back channel negotiations about his return to Tibet. And as we understand, central to that is also the Dalai Lama's, the Dalai Lama agreeing that, you know, that Tibet has always been part of China, which the Dalai Lama has not said. He says that he's no longer seeking Tibetan independence, but he won't accept that it's always been part of China.
And you have talked about the surveillance system there that your undercover journalist had to deal with. And I wanted to just get a sense, if you could, to just talk about how extensive this surveillance system is, and just painting a picture for listeners of what it's like to be in Tibet dealing with this system.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that, you know, when our reporter arrived in Tibet, obviously he noticed surveillance cameras. There are these police posts, every 500 meters in the capital Lhasa, and it's very difficult to obviously investigate on the ground, you know, why these systems are in place and how these systems work, as it's simply just too dangerous and risky. But Greg Walton, a cybersecurity expert who we spoke to, has done a lot of research on this, and what he explains is that, you know, there are these whole sets of systems, some not so obvious to the human eye, live facial recognition systems, scanning systems that will monitor mobile phone signals, and systems that monitor mobile phones and internet surveillance to keep an eye on what people are browsing. But essentially, he talks about what the purpose of all the surveillance is, and he says surveillance is at the heart of this process of subjugating the Tibetan people, and obviously, you know, the Chinese government says that human rights are, you know, at their historical best. But when our reporter visits monasteries, he realizes that, you know, one has to even scan their identity card during a sort of visit to a place of worship, and that all of that our reporter felt is having a real sort of self-censorship impact on people. And he says that, you know, that everyone knows what can be discussed and what can't be discussed.
We're speaking with Geshbin Mohammed, a BAFTA and Emmy-winning journalist and documentary filmmaker and director of Battle for Tibet, the film that we're discussing now, available on Frontline's website. You can join the conversation calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. If you have been to Tibet or have thoughts about what's happening there or have watched the film and have questions for the director, you can also email any questions to yourcall@kalw.org. I'm Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Friday's Your Call Media Roundtable. And Geshbin, in addition to the surveillance state that China has really imposed on Tibet, China has also taken very deliberate and widespread actions to essentially erase Tibetan culture and language. And that is particularly being carried out through a network of boarding schools. Can you talk more about the boarding schools, what's going on inside of them, and any details about what your reporting is uncovering in terms of the impact this is having on families when their kids are being essentially taught to erase their culture.
Of course. And now under President Xi Jinping's government, they've placed essentially around 800,000 Tibetan children into boarding schools where they are taught in Mandarin, and Tibetans have their own language, and that's why this is relevant. And little is obviously known about, you know, what happens in these boarding schools, but inside Tibet, our reporter met a mother whose you know, children can only talk in Mandarin. So they've essentially effectively stopped speaking Tibetan because they are being taught in Mandarin. And then outside of Tibet, we spoke to a leading Tibetan sociologist and educational researcher who's been raising the alarm about China's boarding school policy. And he used to live in Tibet, in a Tibetan area in China. And as an academic, he went around Tibet to investigate what the government was teaching Tibetan children in boarding schools. And he found not just that children were being taught in Mandarin, but he also talks about how the subject areas were there to instill communist ideology and Chinese culture into the Tibetan children. And he essentially worries that their own unique Tibetan culture and language will be destroyed in the next 20 years if these boarding schools continue. And when he started raising the alarm a little inside China about these boarding schools, the university was working at terminated his contract, and Gyallo eventually fled to Canada. And sadly now for him, it's too dangerous to speak to his family that are still in Tibet.
It's such a huge toll, not just on the people in Tibet, but these dissidents, whistleblowers, alarm raisers who are forced to leave their families and their culture and home behind. And so much of what I watched in the boarding school aspect of your documentary really reminded me of U.S. policy towards Native American tribes. You know, U.S., of course, had similar boarding schools to essentially erase Native American tribal culture really through the middle of the last century. So there's certainly a model for this internationally. And I'm just wondering, with the boarding schools in particular, is this a mandatory boarding school requirement for the students? How do they even get all of these students together to go to the boarding schools? Or are there any other options, local public schools, that would be an alternative to these boarding schools for Tibetan families?
Ethan, as you can imagine, and because of the reporting sort of restrictions inside Tibet, it's quite hard to get exact sort of facts on that. But what I can rely on what our sort of sources have told us essentially. And Gyal Lo, who's done, you know, extensive research on this. His own experience is that families are pressured to send their kids to these boarding schools. And that if they don't send their children to boarding schools, that there are sort of indirect sort of punishments. You know, your life might be made more difficult. Such as, you know, you might getting a job might become more difficult suddenly. But there isn't, I guess, what we haven't uncovered evidence of is there being like a policy saying, you know, if you don't send your children, this is what is going to happen to you. But there seems to be testimony coming out and other reporting that suggests that there is some level of pressure to send children to these schools. And I guess the other thing is obviously, you know, which the Chinese government would stress is that, you know, that because of its rule, life in Tibet is significantly better for the people, and that there are, of course, economic developments. But I suppose that, you know, obviously Tibet is such a large region and there's a highly scattered population, so that they have to build these schools and children have to go to these schools. So I suppose that's what the Chinese government would say. But Gyallo certainly has found evidence that there is some level of pressure put on parents to send these their children to schools.
Well, let's talk about the Dalai Lama, because so much of this conflict seems to revolve around the role of the Dalai Lama. As you mentioned just in our interview here, the Dalai Lama is going to be 90 years old this year. And clearly China, from the documents you uncovered or that you reported on that were uncovered in the 1990s, China clearly views the Dalai Lama as essentially a national security threat. And, you know, the Buddhist tradition, the religion in Tibet, basically has individual young boys picked to be the reincarnation of not only the Dalai Lama, but the lama that is supposed to choose, the Panchen Lama that's supposed to choose which boy is the reincarnated next Dalai Lama once this Dalai Lama dies. And China has really engineered and is very keen on focusing on the succession, who might be the next Dalai Lama. And they're taking dramatic steps to manipulate this process. Can you describe what's going on with the Buddhist belief around reincarnation, choosing young boys as the reincarnated versions of these lamas, and how that plays into the politics?
Of course. I mean, reincarnation is very important, and it has played a huge role in Tibetan society since their civilization started thousands of years ago. So in the documentary, we take a sort of special sort of look at what are the events in 1995 and China's efforts to essentially choose the next Dalai Lama. And in 1995, the Dalai Lama chose a six-year-old boy called Gedun Chokinima as the 11th Panchen Lama. And in religious terms, the Panchen Lama plays a critical role in identifying the successor to the Dalai Lama when he passes away. So the role has extreme significance. And China said at the time that the Dalai Lama's announcement was illegal, and the boy who was selected by the Dalai Lama along with his family were taken away by the Chinese government. And we spoke to a senior Lama monk, Arja Rinpoche, who was a witness to the events that unfolded at the time, and who is now in exile running a monastery in Indiana. And he says the Chinese government wants to control the next reincarnation of the Dalai Lama. And this is really particularly important at the moment, because the Dalai Lama is approaching 90, as you say, this year. And as part of this Buddhist senior leadership, Arja Rinpoche, who was living obviously in China at the time, was summoned to Beijing, and he and others were ordered to take part in a ceremony organized by the Chinese government to select a new Panchen Lama, and who is now Gyaltsen Norbu, the son of two Communist Party members. And he was essentially selected as the sort of Chinese approved 11th Panchen Lama, the figure who, according to Tibetan Buddhism, could one day determine the next Dalai Lama. And for Arja Rinpoche and many of our other background interviewees, this was an unacceptable way to select the Panchen Lama, but the Chinese government claimed that they followed Buddhist tradition. But Arja Rinpoche says he eventually, you know, escaped China because he couldn't, he was being forced to accept something that he didn't agree with. And that historical event, I suppose, raises the question about the Dalai Lama's succession when that time comes. Obviously, China claims it must have the final say, while the Dalai Lama has said he will soon decide how his successor should be chosen after his death, or whether to end the institution of the Dalai Lama.
So we do have an email question in. Stephen in Berkeley writes in, does the younger generation in Tibet have the same connection to the Dalai Lama in reference to the older generation and how they revere the Dalai Lama?
Well, I would thank you for the question. I'd probably have to get back to you on that. But it's very hard to say, obviously, because it's very dangerous to talk about the Dalai Lama inside Tibet. So it's very hard to do a sort of a survey or independent poll about it. And it's just very unsafe. So our reporter, obviously, you know, when he was in the capital Lhasa at the Potala Palace, which was obviously the sort of administrative center when the Dalai Lama was ruling from there, and also the Dalai Lama's winter residence. And our reporter did a tour, but one of the things that he notices is, you know, that no one talks about the Dalai Lama. And then he talks with a Tibetan man about why that might be, and he says they're not allowed to talk about the Dalai Lama. So it'd be very hard to assess whether, you know, the connection that younger Tibetans feel to the Dalai Lama.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then what has been the reaction, if any, of the Chinese government to your documentary, just given how sensitive the government is, and it's particularly with this widespread coverage that you're giving this issue within the United States and larger audiences around the world?
Well, Ethan, we haven't, at least to my knowledge, at present, we haven't had any backlash or any response from the Chinese government, aside from obviously their responses to our questions before the film broadcast.
Well, I'm assuming they're monitoring it, but maybe that's a good thing that if you haven't heard anything so far. Last question for you, and then unfortunately we have to let you go, but it's a super fascinating interview and documentary again. But what's next for you now? What projects can we look for from you in the future?
Well, I'm very interested in the ideas of in a world obviously where you know democracy is declining and authoritarianism is increasing. That's a sort of theme that I intend to carry on investigating, particularly around freedom of speech.
Well, we'll look forward to that. Geshbin Mohammed, BAFTA and Emmy winning journalist and director of Battle for Tibet. Thank you so much for coming on Your Calls Media Roundtable, and congratulations again on the film.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I do want to remind listeners, you can stream it on Frontline's website, Frontline's YouTube channel, or the PBS app. Coming up after this short break, we're going to be talking about the U.S. Republican House budget resolution to cut healthcare for low-income Americans in order to give tax cuts to the wealthy, as well as all things latest in Trump land. You can stay with us here on Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back just after this short break. Welcome back. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We're podcasting the show. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org, and you can also listen to our past shows there. And if you have a show idea for us, something you'd like us to cover in a future episode, you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. Well, now I want to welcome to the program David K. Johnston. We're going to talk to him about the Trump administration's unprecedented restrictions on press freedom, as well as the U.S. House budget resolution that passed this week, which would cut $880 billion from Medicaid, the joint federal and state program that helps cover medical costs for low-income Americans. And those cuts would happen over the next decade. Representative Pramila Jayapal from Washington State has described the budget as 99% of House Republicans just voted to gut Medicaid so they can lower taxes for the richest 1%. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, author of several books, including a 2003 tax expose, Perfectly Legal, which won the 2004 Investigative Book of the Year Award, and his biography, The Making of Donald Trump, which received the 2016 Political Biography of the Year Award in Britain. David is a professor of practice at Rochester Institute of Technology and co-founder of DC Report, a nonprofit news organization that reports on the facts of politics. Welcome back to the program, David. It's great to have you with us.
Well, nice to be with you again, Ethan.
Well, David, I have to start by asking you about what just happened today in the Oval Office, an unprecedented argument, shouting match almost between Trump and Ukrainian President Zelensky, where Trump really lost his temper with Zelensky. And I just wanted to get your reaction to what just happened today in the Oval Office, a really unprecedented shouting match between two world leaders at a very precarious time in world history.
Well, for many years, and the audience should know, I've covered Donald since 1988 when I wrote about the prospect he would become president someday. I've tried to get people to understand that Donald is simply a bully. He is appallingly ignorant. He had to be told why there is a memorial in Pearl Harbor over the USS Arizona. I don't know how you can grow up in America and not know about a date that will live in infamy. And so, when he's challenged, he doesn't have any internal psychological, intellectual, or moral core with which to respond. And you're seeing the Donald I've seen many times when it's one-on-one between the two of us. He goes from trying to romance you to bullying you, and if he thinks it's convenient to go back to romance you. And all of this is because he is a complete and total fraud. Donald claims to be the world's greatest expert on 22 subjects, Ethan. One of these I have a worldwide reputation on, tax policy. First of all, there's no one expert in any of those fields, but you couldn't be an expert in that many fields. And it's a good example of what a con artist he is. He just makes it up. A phrase I've used for years is Donald creates his own reality. And I'm now seeing it show up in quotes attributed to other people, which is terrific. So his blowing up at Zelensky, not surprising, and we should be embarrassed that we have such a ill-educated and narcissistic fellow representing us.
Well, and for him to lose his cool, lose his temper, it indicates there's something about this issue, it seems to me, because we haven't quite seen this side of Donald. We've certainly never seen him treat any other world leader in this way. Is there something about the Ukrainian issue in particular that makes him lose his emotional stability?
Well, in the short run of recent time, Donald is furious that he did not get a Nobel Peace Prize. When there was one awarded for someone who was a peacemaker in South Sudan, the administration, when he was president in his first term, congratulated, but Donald did not. And he has publicly complained about Barack Obama getting the Peace Prize. And he said, you know, why don't I have it? Why don't I have it? I mean, that's how shallow and hollow he is inside. The other aspect of this is that since the early 1980s, Russians individually and the Russian government have been courting Donald. He sold many apartments in Trump Tower at serious premiums over the market to Russians, one of whom showed up to buy five apartments with cash. And I don't mean a check, I mean greenbacks. Mm-hmm. Donald was given an all-expenses-paid tour of St. Petersburg and Moscow by the old Soviet back in 1987. The Russians have been finding ways to put money in his pocket ever since. And as Donald has said of both the Russians and the Saudis, you know, hey, these people put, you know, I get money from them. Why should, what's not to like? Because that's how Donald thinks. You know, if you put money in my pocket, then you're a good person. Zelensky is not playing his game. He's not going to play his game. And at the moment, and I think this is a very important thing that's not getting covered very well in the news, Ethan, it's the Russians who are desperate for a ceasefire or an end to the fight. It's been reliably reported in Europe, and I posted about this when it happened, that the Russian army is now getting food and munitions to the front by donkey cart. Because so many of their heavy trucks and whatnot have been destroyed by the Ukrainians in their absolutely brilliant military strategies.
Yeah, well, certainly Russia's invasion of Ukraine has not gone as they expected. And you talk about Donald Trump really admiring a lot of and being courted and feeded by a lot of these Eastern European Russian strongmen. And clearly he admires authoritarians around the world. And as you noted, this is something you've been warning people about for a long time, Donald Trump's authoritarian instincts. And as you look back now, and it's hard to believe it's really just been barely over a month of the second Trump term, have you been surprised by the speed and the scope of Trump's actions? What have you made of this first, you know, month plus of Trump's second term?
Well, there are a couple of pieces I posted at dcreport.org, and DC Report is free. It's ad-free. We don't sell our mailing lists, so people should feel safe to go there about what they're doing. I'm surprised that that Elon Musk has emerged as the co-president, and he clearly is. I mean, all you have to do is look at the cabinet meeting where Donald deferred to Musk, which suggests in my mind that Donald is somehow economically in debt to Elon Musk. Remember, he faces about $600 million in civil court damages that he's appealing. But once the appeals are over, and I don't see any prospect he will win, he's going to owe that money. And so I don't know. Sorry about that. I'm surprised that they're doing all these firings, which are just flat out illegal. As a special government employee, that's what Elon Musk is, the law says that you can advise, you have no power to do anything. And we've seen the spectacle of a high-level Justice Department lawyer tell a federal judge, well, we don't know who's in charge of the DOGE, which is a fictional organization, doesn't exist in the government. So I'm very surprised, number one, the firings. Secondly, I'm surprised at the shutting down of USAID, because it's the organization that corrals really deadly viruses, far more deadly than COVID-19, one of which MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, kills about every third person who's infected. And those viruses are now going to come back in the bodies of the people who were getting antivirals. They're going to start hopscotching around the planet on jetliners, and Americans are going to die. I'm surprised at that. And they're making a big mistake by going after Medicaid, because as no other than Steve Bannon has pointed out, more Republicans depend on Medicaid than Democrats.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the politics of this is going to be interesting, and I definitely want to talk to you more about that. And of course, your message around infectious diseases, we all know how the last Trump term ended with COVID. So certainly hope for everyone's health and safety that won't be the case. Do want to let listeners know we're speaking with David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and also professor of practice at Rochester Institute of Technology and co-founder of DC Report, a nonprofit news organization that reports on the facts of politics. We're talking about the latest in Trump world and the U.S. House Republican budget to cut Medicaid in order to cut taxes for the wealthiest Americans. I'm Ethan Elkind. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and I want to invite listeners to join the conversation. If you've been following the House budget resolution, if you're concerned about what cuts to Medicaid might mean for you or your family or for the country as a whole, if you have thoughts about what Democrats should do or how the politics should play out with this proposed budget cuts, we'd love to hear from you. The number to call to join the conversation, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. Well, David, as we've been talking about, Trump's authoritarian instincts, his sort of transactional personality, something you've been warning about for a long time. You know, just to sort of zoom out here a bit, why do you think someone like Donald Trump has appeal at this moment in U.S. history? How would you explain the popularity? And I know he's not the most popular president. He's actually quite unpopular, but he's gotten elected, reelected. How do you explain that happening in the U.S. at this time?
Well, there are two big forces at work. First of all, and I think the Democrats are heavily to blame here for not successfully representing their historic constituency. Over the last 50 years, the incomes of the bottom 90% of Americans have shrunk. Particularly because things that used to be fringe benefits on top of your pay, healthcare and pensions, now come out of your paycheck, and pay hasn't grown. Pay did start to grow under Biden. In fact, in 2023, the latest data we have, the bottom half of workers' pay increased 20% faster than the top half. And that hasn't happened for 30 years. I analyze these numbers every year, that it's been the top pulling away, especially the top 10% have been pulling away from everybody, but it changed under Biden. On the other hand, very few Americans know that. I mean, I do lots of talk radio where people, you know, say, this is the worst economy in American history. We're in the middle of a Biden's depression, because they're being lied to by the organizations they listen to. And why do they listen to them? Because Donald tells them those are the only honest news organizations. Don't listen to the New York Times, the AP, the LA Times, because they're liars. And so people who don't listen or read those news organizations, they don't know what's actually going on in our economy. So the long term is this horrible economic pressure, if not terror, on a large segment of the American population. The second element is the absolute brilliance of Donald as a con artist in selling himself as this genius leader who, you know, we love you. It says it at every meeting. We love the poorly educated. While the Democrats talk in terms of, well, if you read page 15 of my analysis, if you look at footnote 7, especially the subsection of footnote 7, you know, they don't know how to communicate, and it's not that they haven't been told this for 40 years.
And I think you bring up such an important point about the wage inequality. I mean, particularly thinking about Americans without college degrees and just multiple decades of stagnant, declining wages, while prices have been rising at the same time, and it's hard to recover from that, you know, overnight. But I'm wondering what you think Democrats should be doing, should be arguing. What are they advocating for to address that type of income inequality? Because, you know, a social safety net, which has traditionally been the Democrats' sort of, you know, hallmark policy, is not going to necessarily address economic inequality and falling wages.
Well, I think that Democrats and those Republicans who are not Trumpers, they're principled Republicans, and there are lots of them, they've just been cowed, should be doing a couple of things. Number one, they should be doing everything they can to call out these terrible things Trump is doing, like cutting Medicare. My piece that's at the top of the DC Report front page right now is about how the Trump administration has just ensured that thousands of Americans more will die next winter because of an action they just took that's gotten a fair amount of news coverage, but I don't think anywhere near as much as it should. It's been bureaucratic coverage, not what does this mean to you and your family. They should be in every way they can asking for explanations. Where is the money? What are you doing here? They should be emphasizing the reason that the House budget resolution is the way it is to give $4.5 trillion in new tax, in continuing and new tax cuts to the top 10th and 100th of 1% of the population. You got to somewhere cut spending. So take it from the children, the disabled, the elderly, the sick, that is the people who cannot fight back, and then create this nonsense that federal employees aren't coming to work. By the way, if you cut all the federal employees, it would take about 1 or 1.5% of the federal spending down. And of course, the government would cease to function. And the Democrats should be driving these things home, that when Trump says, oh, we discovered $50 billion of fraud in Social Security, they need to be out there saying that's a lie. Not saying that's not what it shows. They need to be clear. Donald Trump lies. He's lying to you. And they shouldn't mince their words about it.
And David, let's talk about the politics of all the politics of the budget specifically. I mean, you just talked about, you know, firings of federal workers, but also these proposed Medicaid cuts, many of which are going to really harm Republican states, Republican leaning states, Republican leaning districts. What do you think is going to happen going forward with Republicans potentially needing to push back on these kind of draconian budget cuts? How do you think this is going to play out with Congress?
Well, on this issue, Ethan, you know, the old line, politics make strange bedfellows. I'm with Steve Bannon. Bannon has warned, do not cut the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid because Republicans rely on it more than Democrats. And I think he's exactly right about that. We're beginning to see small business people and farmers going to their lawmakers and saying, hey, this is not what we voted for. This is a real problem. I was in Washington a week before last, and one of the most senior Democrats in the House told me about Republican lawmakers he knows who've been there like he has for decades coming to him and saying, this guy's going to get me unelected. What do I do? And he was chuckling a little about, Gee, it's not my job as a Democrat to bail you out, pal. And I think you're going to see very much the Democrats are going to say, hey, you know, you made your choices. Let's live. You're going to have to live with them. The Democrats need to be telling people when they see these things, they're not the party for you. If you think billionaires are doing something for you, just look at the budget and the plan for tax cuts. We're the party representing you.
We're speaking with David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and author of several books, including The Making of Donald Trump, which received the 2016 Political Biography of the Year Award in Britain. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Would love to hear from you, our listener, if you would like to call to join the conversation, if you have thoughts about what Democrats should do to fight the proposed U.S. House Republican budget that was passed to cut Medicaid in order to pay for tax cuts for the wealthiest. If you are personally affected by any cuts to Medicaid or to the Affordable Care Act, the number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us an email with your question or comment to yourcall@kalw.org. Well, David, you've spoken at fair length here about what Democrats should do, but let's talk about the media, with all of the shocks to the system from mass firings, freezing of funds, mass deportation, threatening foreign governments, like we just heard with President Trump and President Zelensky. Do you think the U.S. media is meeting this moment. And I also can't help but think about cutbacks at the Washington Post right now. How do you gauge what's happening with the U.S. media and their ability to cover what's happening right now?
Well, I've been writing press criticism for more than 50 years. I'm the only journalist who caused a chain of broadcast stations to be forced to go out of business over news manipulations. And what I've been watching from the Washington Press Corps is ineffective, overly polite, and bureaucratic coverage. Yesterday, when you had British journalists in the room traveling with Keir Starmer, their prime minister, you saw tough questions challenging Donald Trump and pointing out that he had said things that aren't true, like calling Zelensky a dictator when Putin is the dictator. And I'm hoping that this induces some spine in reporters, because Trump lies all the time. He deflects. He doesn't answer questions. And he's not challenged about that. And journalists need to start saying, I'm sorry, Mr. President, that wasn't the question. Mm-hmm. And they need to ask short, simple questions.
Well, we've also seen unprecedented restrictions on press access. Trump blocked the AP from major events at the Oval Office, Air Force One, et cetera. And what should the media do in response to these moves to limit which outlets are able to monitor what's happening and talk to the president and ask questions?
Yeah, well, this is what authoritarian governments do. They pick who gets to cover them. And it's the reason, you can see this in my pieces at DC Report, I've said Donald is now, at this point, our de facto dictator. He hasn't fully consolidated power, though the firing of top generals and admirals, which I've warned about for years, is the classic sign of a dictatorship. And so news organizations need to, first of all, go to court. Now, the president could decide to shut down the press room at the White House. But what he shouldn't be allowed to do is say, you're going to be here because you work for this news organization that calls me wonderful, and you're not going to work for it because you're honest and use the proper name for the Gulf of Mexico. And hopefully we will see federal judges, including Trump appointees, uphold the principles of the First Amendment of the free press, and that presidents and others don't get to pick who covers them. A long time ago, when I was with the San Jose Mercury, I was assigned to write about zero population growth, and they wanted me to go away because at the time, I think I had 5 of my 8 children. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't be here. And the editors told them, tough luck, you get who we assigned. And that's what the press should be doing. And mm-hmm. You don't have to be in the White House to cover the White House. I've built a whole career going back to the 60s of covering Washington without ever being there. Mm-hmm. A few days at a time.
Oh, such good advice and thoughts about what the media can do to try to meet this moment. I want to go to the phone lines. We have Greg in Palo Alto calling in. Greg, welcome to Your Calls Media Roundtable. Do we have Greg? All right, not sure if we have Greg on the line. Hello. We'll see if we can. Oh, are you there?
Yeah, hello.
Yes, hi. Yeah, please join us. What's your question?
Hey, good. The comment I had was, the hapless Democrats aren't doing much in Congress to try and deal with this. And they've been hapless for decades. So, I mean, there's no, you can't depend on them. The only person who's doing anything out there is Bernie Sanders and a few people in Congress. The real question I have, though, for David K. Johnson is this. Where does Elon Musk get his legal authority to do what he's doing? And why haven't the Democrats or somebody sued him? Because there is no constitutional or legal authority for him to do what he's doing.
Yeah, such a great question. Greg, yeah, what are your responses to that, David?
Greg, I'm glad you asked that question. Elon Musk doesn't have any authority. Special government employees who can only serve a few days only have advisory authority. There are lawsuits that have been brought. They've been brought by unions representing federal workers. They've been brought by attorneys general. One of the problems is the issue of standing. Do you have the right to bring litigation because of your position? And by and large, one of the things we've discovered since Trump's first term is the federal court's view is, yeah, the Constitution says you can't do that, but nobody has standing to bring it in court. That's what happened with the emoluments cases, where Donald Trump was getting money from foreign governments and state and local governments in violation of the Constitution. But the court said, gee, you don't have any standing to challenge this. This is a real flaw in our Constitution that will need to get addressed. But the employees through their unions and individually, they do have pretty clear standing. And mm-hmm. Congress, well, the Republicans, whom I've taken to calling the Quisling Republicans, mm-hmm. You don't know Quisling, look up Norway and World War II. The Quisling Republicans are so afraid of losing in a primary race, they won't challenge anything Trump is doing. Mm-hmm. So these town halls where people are showing up at Republican meetings and really laying into these Republicans are, I think, a very important element. And focusing on this guy, Musk, should be out of there now, is one of the messages.
Well, Greg, thank you for that question. We're almost out of time, but I want to try to squeeze in one more caller. We have Jay in Berkeley. Jay, if you can make it brief, we'd love to hear from you. Do we have Jay? All right. Well, we may not have Jay. So we're just about out of time, David, but I did just want to ask you, do you have any advice for reporters now going forward? Just very briefly, what should they be focusing on here?
Look at what they do, not what they say. Ask short, focused questions. And when there's avoidance of the question, hit them back. And I hope people who are frustrated they can't do anything, go see my piece at the top of DC Report, because we have an action box on what you can do. And you can do something that will save lives with a phone call. And you'll see why in the piece.
All right. Well, and I do hope Jay and Berkeley can call back in on another show. And I just want to thank you, David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and author of The Making of Donald Trump, also a professor of practice at Rochester Institute of Technology and co-founder of DC Report. Thank you so much for joining us on Your Calls Media Roundtable.
Thank you, Ethan. Thank you, Ethan.
And that's our show. Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review and email any show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Balihe Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.